Rebecca McLaren.
Yes, well,
might get out a pen.
And it's awesome to see.
On ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
Your guests today are all storytellers at the core of it, but in different ways. Future D Fidel tells his stories through music and on the stage, but last year he transformed his incredibly popular play Prize Fighter, which you may have caught at the Darwin Festival last year, into a novel. Fiona Wright writes just about everything, though we'll find out if that includes scripts. She's published essays and poetry and novels. She's also an editor and critic. She's been included more than once in that exclusive club of writers on the list for the Stella Prize, among many others. Curly Saunders is a Gunai woman with ties to the Yuin, Gundagara, Gadigal and Birripi people, who writes poetry and children's books, and she's the founder of the Poetry in First Languages project, encouraging Australia's First Nations people to share and preserve language through poetry. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Do you remember your first story, whether it was writing it down or telling it?
It's hard because every time you get a different story, you're like, oh, that's nice. But then after a few hours, you're like, ah, maybe it's not too good. And then you have those kind of stories that pop up every now and then. But, you know, I think you only write the ones that stick out, you know. Although you may want to have a particular story you want to tell and then dig it in and write those ones down. But stories are always everywhere, you know. As soon as you open your eyes, you put your feet off the floor when you wake up, stories are there. And so I guess it's hard to tell when you can write your first story and how, when that was or how that happened.
Future for you, was it telling stories? Was it something you would think about, how to engage and keep a captive audience, even if that was an audience of your mates or family?
I think the first plan is always to entertain, making sure that your audience, it doesn't matter whether it's just one person or two, they need to be able to be like, oh, tell me more. Continue. And so that's always the trick of telling storytelling. And I think I learned this from my early ages when we're, you know, young and we'd be sitting around the fire, and then the oldest people would be telling us stories about, you know, fantasy stories and true stories and all this. And so for me, it was more of like, okay, I want to be able to tell those stories and captivate my audience, lock them in so that they don't leave. So I guess that's it.
When you talked about captivating stories, then it got me dreaming of when I was really little. Some of my earliest experiences with stories were being on the top bunk of my bed in, you know, my shared room with my sister, and Dad coming in probably before he was off to night shift to work in a prison, and he'd tell us a ghost story from the prison. And so, you know, we'd be hooked and terrified, and wouldn't want to sleep. But those are some of my early experiences of storytelling, and obviously oral storytelling and that tradition of a bedtime story. And so I think stories have always been a really important part of learning and communicating in our family. And traditionally, I think that's really true too. Mm-hmm. But my first story, I remember the first story that I wrote, I have no idea what it's about, but I know that it is stapled together at the corner and folded in half, and that it's at home somewhere in a box, and that the spelling is terrible. And it was probably about the weekend. And Mum and Dad were thrilled that I'd written a book. That was, it's a nice memory, a very grounding memory now when you see a book on a bookshelf, that your earliest stories were things that were told to you on a bed bunk or something stapled, dog-eared and torn on the corners.
And for you, really, Fiona?
It's funny, I can't think of a first story. I know I was a voracious reader as a kid, you know, always reading. It made me so popular. but... You know, I grew up in a house full of books too. My mother's also a really big reader, and reading was always a part of my life, and writing as well. You know, writing down little stories and little songs, as I thought of them, which it took me years to realize was kind of a poetry kind of a thing. But of course, I didn't know anything about that at that point. So it was something that I was always doing consciously or otherwise, but not something I really thought about properly until much, much later, I think. I had this idea too that I wasn't very good at writing at school because all of the creative writing, at least, that we were ever asked to do was short stories, and I still can't write short stories. it turns out it was just the wrong form.
I agree with that, Fiona. Mm. I didn't think of myself as a writer until I was at university and we had a subject that encouraged us to write a kid's picture book. I studied teaching. To engage our students in that creative writing process for ourselves. And so, yeah, I definitely didn't think of myself as a writer, particularly until, university.
Yeah, yeah.
Future, when did you be able to call yourself a writer?
I think I wouldn't say I was always writing, but storytelling has always been there. I mean, when I came to Australia in 2005, I sort of like started getting into writing stories and writing short films and stuff like that. And I guess in that sense, I was looking at myself as a writer. I was looking at myself as a storyteller. And so I think it was a matter of translating that into a page or into a form that other audience or a particular audience can relate to and be like, oh yeah, this is all right. That's why I've gone from playwright to novel to film, and so yeah.
You're with Rebecca McLaren.
You read my mind.
On ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
Glad to have your company this afternoon, joined by some guests who will be appearing at the NT Writers Festival in Alice Springs, Fiona Wright, Future D. Fidel and Curly Saunders. Now, Fiona, I'd like to talk about your writing because it strikes me as extremely personal, and maybe if it were me, I would feel exposed. You wrote about your illness after you'd had treatment. Were you writing at all while you were sick?
I was, but I was mostly writing poetry. Poetry was my first practice and my first love. We've been separated for a little while now, and I really miss poetry. And I'm really hoping to write some more as soon as I get a little bit of brain space. So I was always writing, and those poems are really interesting to me now because they don't have much of a self in them. They're very descriptive of stuff that's going on in the world and of other people, but my presence is absent, actually, in all of them, which kind of fascinates me, and because I think that's very much how I was existing at the time, anorexia is very much a disease of self-effacement in some way, and even my writing had that in it. So I started writing the kind of more personal essays while I was in treatment, and it was essentially because what happened was, I had a physical condition first that affected the way that I was eating and my relationship with food, and the rest of it all kind of spiraled on top of that. But because the physical condition had been there first for a very long time, I was able to tell myself that that was all what was going on. And the way that I was eating was just a way of managing that condition to make sure I wasn't vomiting left, right and center. Nothing more harmful or dangerous than like a celiac not eating bread, And when I was finally at the point where I was forced to kind of recognize that there was something else going on, it felt like the rug of my existence, as it were, had been pulled out from under my feet. I had no idea, all of the narratives I've been telling myself about who I was for the entirety of my adult life had been false. And I felt like all the pieces of myself had been thrown up into the air, and I didn't know where they were going to land. And I felt like writing about this was a way that at least I'd have some way of making shape of it, or having some kind of, at least being able to direct those pieces in a little bit, I was trying to figure out what had happened to me, basically. And you can't do that without that kind of personal experience in it too. But I also think it's a really important thing to do because the other reason I was able to be sick for so long without recognizing what was going on was that the cultural narratives that we have around anorexia and the sort of person it happens to are completely false, but they were all I knew. So I was like, oh, well, I'm not like that. That isn't what's happening to me. So I wanted to write against that and be like, actually, all of the ideas we have are wrong, and this is what it's actually like. if that makes any sense.
When you talk about that perception and that's not me, do you mean you weren't striving to get on a catwalk?
Yeah. I didn't want to be thin, and I've never had any dysmorphia too. I knew how bad I looked, you know, but it was more like you had this idea that it only happens to teenagers, and they're like selfish little rich girls who just want to be pretty, and they're vain and they're manipulative and selfish and all of these sorts of ideas. And it's complete rubbish. They're diseases that happen to people who think too much and care too much and put other people before themselves all the time, who are anxious and uncertain of themselves and their place in the world, and people who are absolutely just like me and absolutely like a lot of the people that I know, especially young women. But it was that narrative is so strong that I was able to push away the idea that this was happening for me. And people are like, oh, you must have known on some level, but I absolutely did not. It's, you know, the strength of that denial was incredible.
And I think from my point of view anyway, there's that incredible honesty that comes with putting pen to paper. And it was interesting when you said that you miss poetry, because I used to write a lot as well. Yeah. As a teenage angst used to pour out of me onto the page. And it was a particularly distressing time that I wrote a lot, and then I stopped because I didn't want to feel that future. Or Curly, do you have sometimes an aversion to writing something down because of the feeling that will come back, or does that help you to deal with the feeling?
I was told that I met Stan Grant. I opened for him when he was he and Warren Mundine were sharing their works. Warren Mundine was launching his book, and I sat with Uncle Stan and said, can you share some wisdom with me? What do I do with my writing? And he said, kiddo, all writers need to take the universal and make it personal. And that really stuck, because I think, Fiona, I admire your personal power to step into your vulnerability and to make your personal story accessible and to speak to the universal, because I do agree, you know, being a woman having experienced disordered eating, not necessarily an eating disorder, I know what it's like to feel like you need to be a certain thing, and because you're worried about everybody else. There are times where I've thought, oh, I can't write that. But my whole poetry collection that came out last week is mostly a collection of those poems of, oh, I can't write that, but I'm going to anyway.
I think that's where the powerful stuff happens too, right? Like the stuff that you're ashamed of or nervous about or anxious about is the stuff that other people are carrying but not talking about.
Yes. And I think, you know, if we write the poems, if we write the plays, the stories, if we share those, then that narrative becomes one that is being spoken instead of an underlying silent conversation that needs to be had.
What makes a story or a poem or anything powerful is if it's coming from the heart, if it's personal. Because then you have an audience who can also relate to that and be like, oh, wow, I know a friend or myself, I've been through this. And so I think that is what's more important as a writer or as any artist, to be able to express what's coming deep from your heart, because then you can relate to other people can relate to your story, other people can relate to the idea or the poem or anything that you talk about.
Future, were there aspects, while your book is not entirely memoir, it's based on experiences and people that you knew, were there aspects of the trauma from back home that you were writing about and those young soldiers that was difficult for you to write?
There was a few moments, there was a few moments where I would write and I would just stop, because it sort of like hits me hard. I would just leave it and just go for a walk and go do something else. And sometimes when a tear will fall, when a tear will drop, where I think about relieving that moment, although it's not something that I may have included in the book, but having the idea of relieving that time, it brings back memories and not so good memories. And so, it's one of those things where you have to tell the story. And if you want it to make an impact, you want it to have an impact, you have to tell it exactly the same way you think it is or how it happened. And so, I had to really relieve that moment and be able to put it on paper again.
Is there a particular moment that you're talking about there?
Well, there's a few moments. For example, for me, I wasn't a child soldier, so those are moments whereby it's a story that I've heard or experienced. People who have gone through that. But there was time, for example, where we got captured. We were going from town to town. We got captured, and then these soldiers, we had girls. They took girls and they started raping them. Right, and we are there, which was something that is unusual. Something that when you think about it, it's just you can accept that these things are happening. Another time where I escaped death, where I was already, the soldiers took us and put us into soccer fields, and they were gonna shoot all of us. And there they started arguing, and they told all of us to go. And so when I think about all these moments and I'm feeling, wow, this, if I didn't survive there, I wouldn't have been in Australia. And so these are the things where, although that might not be on paper but it's the story that will live in your memories for a long time. When I went back to the Congo in 1999, we will go into a field where we'll find decomposing corpses. And so as a little boy, you see these images. And also when people, some of the armies go to war, they'll come back with people's heads on spikes. And so these kind of images, you can vividly see, and they will live with you for a very, very long time.
Does that become difficult for you to reconcile then if you're reliving these moments in your mind and telling these important stories for other people to hear, but sitting in comfortable Brisbane typing at a computer?
I think being able to tell the world that these things are happening is what's important. But also for me, it's my duty, or it's my obligation, to be able to oppress that and be like, yeah, I'm not there now, I'm no longer there, I'm a different person, I'm in a different, safer environment, so these things ain't gonna happen here, but I need to tell the story so that other people are aware of it. And so that's why I can comfortably say those events and talk about it, because I know it happened in the past and I accepted it, and now I think it's a matter of knowing or pretending as if, okay, it's all a fantasy.
Curly, I introduced you as a Gunai woman, and I'm from that area as well in East Gippsland, and where I was born, does that make me born on Gunai country? And in trying to look that up on the internet, everything that comes up connecting Mafra, the town that I was born in, to the word Gunai comes up with massacres. So is there that level of trauma? Does that come into looking back and embracing these languages, trying to preserve them? Is that something that you deal with too?
Yeah. So Poetry in First Languages seeks to celebrate and share First Nations languages. We commission at Red Room Poetry First Nations poets to publish poems in language, and then we support students on country with elders and custodians to write poems in language. One of the first experiences that we always have at the start of a workshop is to have a smoking ceremony and then go around the circle with our leading poets and custodians and introduce ourselves. And so we talk about our family history, where we come from, who our family are, and then we explain why we give that introduction. In my family history, we've got my mum being removed from country and raised as a state ward in children's homes, separate from her siblings, not to see her parents again, her nan's letters kept from her. We've got families raised on missions, scooped up from their traditional country, raised off country, without language, without culture, with all elements of life ordered and prescribed for them. And so having conversations with little ones about where they come from, or why they might not know where they come from, and explaining the ways that intergenerational traumas carry and the shame and what that feels like as an embodiment. This week we had a kid sort of touch just below his sternum on his stomach and say, "Oh, sis, it's in here, auntie, it's in here." And I'm like, "Oh, it is, isn't it?" It's like that yucky feeling in your belly. He goes, yeah, that's where you feel it. That's where you feel shame. And I thought, I said, and these are the reasons that we feel shame. We've had our identities told to us, and we've had our histories, scattered with all of these traumas, and we haven't had time to really sit and talk about that. So let's sit and talk about it. And so, exploring trauma is a big underpinning in the workshops, and we aim to explore those things so that we can go into hopefully supporting and well-being and helping little ones on their journey. When I say little ones, I mean primary age years 3 to 6 and then high school years 7 to 11, but they're little ones to me. And yeah, going through those conversations, exploring our family history, finding strength in those, finding unity in our displacement, or unity in our belonging. You know, we are all raised on this country, or we're all living here now, or we have family ties here. You know, I think there's a lot of power in that. And then the language learning means that students get to use new words to describe parts of their identity that they might not have had before. And that comes with a big light. You know, you can see little ones glowing, our students glowing with that connection. And we try and accompany language learning with bush medicine knowledge, with smoking ceremony, with dance, art making, all guided by custodians and elders, all guided by poets, and then of course poetry writing, which I think is a very freeing exercise. I think it goes back to traditional ways of sharing story through song. Songs to me are poems. Yeah, it's a really grounding, really profound thing to be a part of, and I'm so excited to work on Aranda Country this week with the Northern Territory Writers Festival, Declan Ferber-Gillick, some local Aranda custodians, and with Red Room.
In learning those new words and exploring language, I guess you get to be exposed to lots of different languages in different workshops.
Oh, 100%. Where possible, we try and have a poet from country delivering the workshop, so I'll be accompanying Declan. But it does mean for me, you know, learning. I've learned sort of across 4 of the language groups that I have ties to now, or 3 of those, and then additional languages on top of that. And so I'm always looking at the moon going, what's your name here? Tree, what do we call you? Are you, you Kundu or Darumbayang, you know? It's pretty special.
It would be a really special way if we were all able to look at the world that way. I think if the languages were out there and accessible, which is something that I do hope we'll find in the future. Often you hear people say, oh, there's this great word in German that explains this feeling between this thing. Do you think we can find those words in traditional languages if we just
look? Oh, we do. Yeah. I had the pleasure of, you know, having a good chat with the very velvety Dan Browning, who's behind Away with ABCRN. And just talking with him about languages and sharing my love of those words that have that multiple word description. And patua is a Gadigal language word, which means to warm your hands by the fire while gently squeezing the fingertips of another person's. And yeah, so they're out there and they're beautiful. And it would be really lovely to see those words reintroduced. Patua.
Future, do you have words from your first language that might work for us that we can take from this conversation?
Well, it depends what kind, because I can fluently speak my dialect. I also can fluently speak Swahili, which is another national language in the East Africa. Not so much as French, because it's been a while and I haven't really been practicing French. So I think I can do that.
Given that you had to learn English once you came to Australia to embrace that in your storytelling, did it take you some time to come to love English in the way that you might need to express yourself?
Yeah, it always does take time, because every time you go, I mean, I've lived in from the Congo till I came to Australia, it's been, you know, places and places, place after place. And so every place you go, you have to start learning a new language and the culture and things like that. And so when I came to Australia, I didn't know English. I probably, the only thing I knew was yes and no. And so when you start learning English, it becomes another experience, a new experience. So you need to be able to understand it fully. Up until now, I feel like I still don't. I don't know really much. I don't really know much. But I just have to push and push and push, and making sure that if I write a story, people should be able to communicate and understand at least what I'm trying to say, get a message across. And so, yeah, it's always great, even. And I feel it. I feel happy always, you know, to be able to learn a new language. It's always exciting.
Rebecca McLaren.
Definitely representing Territory.
On ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
Joined by writers appearing at the NT Writers Festival for 2019, Fiona Wright, Future D. Fidel, and Curly Saunders. The theme of this year's festival is Lyapitnam, or returning, but not just in a travel from one place and back again sense. Now, I love this example from the festival program from Arunda elder Therese Ryder. It's shoots growing back after a fire, that the spirit is still there waiting to return. What does the theme of the festival mean to you? How do you connect it with your work? Fiona?
Yeah, it's really interesting to me at the moment, because the last book I wrote, The World Was Whole, when I started writing it, I imagined it as being a book about home and a book about the idea of home, and writing from the place of someone who's never really felt at home in the world in general. And of course, illness is a kind of further complication of that. It really makes you reconsider all of the kind of things that you thought normal, ordinary, just the way things were, when they get disrupted and you have to reconsider those things. So I always had this idea of how do we think about home, how do we find home, how do we try and return to a sense of homeliness or wholeness while I was writing. But the more essays I wrote and the more I kind of thought about this, I realized I was also writing about belonging, and then I was also writing about ritual and routine and the way that we use those to kind of return to a sense of ordinariness or a sense of self. But it really wasn't until the very last essay that I wrote that I realized that what I was actually writing about all this time was grief, because I was kind of carrying this idea in my head of the person I'd been before I got sick, and a lot of the language around treatment for mental illness in particular or for eating disorders in particular, you know, it's called recovery, right? To recover something. This idea that you're going to go back to the person that you were before and pick up where you left off or kind of return to normality. And I realized, not because of why I was writing, but because of other stuff that was going on in my life, that just actually isn't going to be the case for me. And that I had to reconcile myself to the idea of disability and of living with chronic illness and of this being just a different way that I am in the world now. And it took me a long time to realize that tied up in that is a process of grieving, both for that younger self and for the idea of the person that I thought I was going to grow up to be. So it's kind of the ideas I've been tossing around have been less about returning and more about finding a different way to be unreturned, which is a hard thing to do, and it's not the kind it, and it kind of resists a lot of the narratives that we have around the way that our lives are supposed to play out. But it's a really powerful thing. It's hard to do, and it's something that I'm still grappling with, but it's made living with my illness a lot easier in a really strange way.
Future or Curly, would you like to reflect on the theme, Lyapitnam?
So I guess a lot of my poems speak to that returning, the arrival back on country, back on Gunungurra country where I was raised, the language returning into that, and the experiences of learning about those sacred places for what they are, and I guess the knowledge and wisdom, the custodianship being returned in that. Mm-mm. So there's definitely that theme in my poetry. One of my books forthcoming with Scholastic, Happy Ever After, is the story of my mum being taken from country and raised as a state warden in children's home. And the revisiting of that conversation with my mum was, when you spoke before, Future, about the book being written with tears, that definitely rang true. That manuscript is tear-stained. And that was one of those conversations that needed to be had, that hurt to hear the whole thing, you know, to hear the truth and to know the atrocities of the past. And so I guess in returning to it, I'm hoping that when that book comes out and the publisher said to me, Curly, this is haunting and necessary, we'd love to publish it, you know, we feel like, is there any way you can make this story? Is there a positive motif that you can embed And I almost said, this is not a happy story. You know, I can talk to the willows, because the willows and the poplars, they are the motif that I drew on, and they're present on the country that Mum was moved to, and they grow back home where she was taken from. So that idea of regeneration through plant is evident there too. But my hope is that in sharing that story, that hopefully we don't return there ever again. And I know that our kids are being taken now at a rate which is higher than it was in the Stolen Generations, and that breaks my heart. But I like to hope that it will change, that we can put things in place to make sure that doesn't happen again. And then, of course, in poetry and first languages, the work I do with language regeneration and revitalization, celebration with Red Room poetry, that's definitely that idea of returning. Coming back to country, sitting with elders and custodians, making time for deep listening, learning language.
And visiting country that you have a connection to, where you have not grown up, Curly, you've been back to Kaurna country. What was the experience?
Yeah, so over Christmas, my partner and I road tripped around Tasmania, and on our way down, we stopped on Yuin country and spent some time there, and we also stopped on Kaurna country around Lake Tyres. So that's following my matrilineal line. Yeah, I really expected to feel a lot more connected with Lake Tyres. I sat on the banks there. I kicked my shoes off and rubbed my feet in the sand. I walked through the water. I took time just to sit and be still and to listen. And I settled on the idea, after speaking with my partner and another custodian, that it's a historical connection rather than a cultural connection to that space. And so it's prompted me then to want to learn, if my family were only taken and raised on the mission, then where did they come from before that? And I have trawled archives and had many, many conversations to get to this point, three generations or four generations back. So it'll be really interesting for me to continue that journey. And I like going on the journey at the same time as the kids I'm teaching. I think there's a nice synergy there. I think there's a unity and that kindredness in undertaking the journey at the same time. Yeah.
You mentioned, was it Nan's letters being kept from your mum?
Yeah, Nan Hoskins was my mum's favourite human. And Nan, I've heard lots of stories of Nan protecting kids from the black cars as they'd arrive. And yeah, lots of stories of Nan, you know, helping them fish traditionally in the river and catch eels, and just how she would teach them to live off the land and to, yeah, old ways of knowing and being.
Do you have those letters now? Were they destroyed?
I believe so, yeah.
Oh, that breaks my heart so
much. Yeah.
We do just have a few minutes left together, so I would like to turn to homework, and I set you homework for this conversation just in case you didn't do it now. Maybe you've had enough time to cram to ask a question of each other. Future, would you like to go first?
Well, I guess a question I want to ask to both of the girls, Fiona and Kel, is what are the most profound moments in your writing, whether it's poetry or storytelling? What are your profound moments?
Oh, that's good.
That's a good question.
I don't know if this answers the question properly, but one thing I've learned when I sit down to write something, or when I'm working on something, sometimes I get this feeling that, you know, a lot of what I'm doing in essays is bringing two different ideas together and like banging them together to see what happens. And sometimes I get this feeling where I'm thinking about it, or thinking about the experience and what I'm writing about. And I'm like, this is either going to be a complete disaster or it's going to be great. And I've learned that is when I know something profound is going to happen. Now, don't get me wrong, often it's a disaster. But I feel like I've learned to kind of trust that feeling, that it means that you're doing something that's different and exciting and tricky, and hopefully new.
Fiona, would you like to return the favour and ask Future your question?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, Future, about adaptation, which is a super nerdy writer question. But the process of adapting a play into a novel, I can't get my head around how that works. What was it like?
Yeah, that was my question too. Can't
well, look, it's on my list as well.
Well, let me answer all of them at once then. I think it's always great. And for me, I've always, the idea of storytelling is when you're writing a screenplay or a play, stage play, it's more visual. Whereas when you're writing into a novel, it becomes descriptive, where you have to let the audience be in the moments and understand everything, feel the things that the protagonist is feeling, and be able to smell what the protagonist is smelling and things like that. And so it's challenging at some point if you don't really know the full story, but also it's great. I mean, that's what's more important about writing a novel, writing a book, because you can go deeper into the story and flesh out everything so that you can tell the story that the reader will be able to read and understand and know what you are talking about. Whereas in a play, it's visual, it's there. You're writing the words for the actors, you're writing the description for the director to be able to direct the actors and be like, okay, the writer here wants you to do this and wants you to do that. Whereas in the book, all that comes in the form of the reader being able to understand. So the reader becomes the actor and the director at the same time, as you need to be able to communicate.
Did you keep the dialogue? If we read the play script side by side with the novel, are the characters saying some of the same things out loud?
Yeah. You'll find that there's a few times where it's the exact same thing. And so, because it's the same moment, and you want to just, you might expand it a little bit into the book so that the reader can understand, oh, where did this conversation start? How did it start? How did it end? So you can frame that around. But it's most of the time, it's pretty much the same, yeah.
Curly, I know you have a good question for Fiona.
Fiona, we were talking off air earlier about accessibility in venues, in being able to get to writers' festivals. And I was just wondering if you could, I mean, that's a broader conversation happening in the arts, I think, at the moment. If you could just talk to that a little bit.
Yeah, I've been having a very hard time getting to Alice Springs, it turns out. One of the things that has helped me a lot in recent years is I have an assistance dog now, a psychiatric assistance dog, and they're a fairly new phenomenon in this country, but she's changed my life and made it a lot easier for me to go places and do things that I wasn't able to do before. And she's fully qualified and fully certified, and part of that is that they meet the hygiene standards and things like that, but I'm having a lot of trouble getting her onto a plane. and it's kind of a policy thing, and I've been asked to fill in kind of forms and then provide more paperwork and more documentation and more evidence, and it's been going on for weeks and weeks and weeks now. And it's this strange thing where it is so strange to me that the onus needs to be on me as the disabled person to prove both that I'm disabled, that I need my disability aid, and that my disability aid is appropriate to be used in public or in an enclosed space. It's been really, really tricky. But hopefully we're nearly there.
That allies... people without disability, non-disabled people, can support these happening, so that, you know, that way you can get your dog on a plane easily. Is there anything that other parts of the public audience can be doing that we can be doing?
I don't know in this particular circumstance. I feel like the more people know that these things are happening, and the more these conversations start happening, that helps, because awareness is such a huge thing. You know, most of the time when I'm denied entry or my entry is questioned anywhere, it's just because people aren't aware, and the moment I explain what's going on, it's fine. We just need to, that awareness, I guess, is just a thing that is still in its kind of early stages and really...
And it shouldn't
growing.
Be, because guide dogs have had this accessibility allowed to them for such a long time now.
Yeah,
and it's
so
common. We know what good assistance dogs can do, particularly in the PTSD, former military or former emergency services space. It's spoken about so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, a lot of people who work with the organisation I work with are ex-military and also first responders, and it's ridiculous that these people have to fight for their rights. Having helped other people.
Well, I certainly hope that we see you at the festival at the end
too.
Of this week. We'll stay in touch and keep updated on the situation. Fiona, would you like to ask your question of Curly?
Oh, I wanted to ask you, Curly, but you sort of answered it a little bit about what drew you to poetry in the first place, because I do feel like it's such a it's an odd form in a way, and it's not you know, I think when you say you're a writer, people assume that you write novels.
Yeah. Let's face it, it's not trendy.
It's
not rock and roll.
Making it cool before it's cool, you know.
And I love asking poets these questions because everyone's got a different way in.
100%. Yeah, so I guess my journey into poetry was a little unorthodox. I was writing picture books, and I sat down with a friend, Yvette Pichoglian, who's an author, and she said, "Curls, that's poetry." And I said, "Nah, it's a picture book." And she said, "Well, it definitely is, but also it's a very long poem, and it's more of a prose poem, and you should start to read poems." And so then I got into reading a lot more widely. My first introduction to poetry was in the classroom. I had a really phenomenal English teacher. Throw out to you, Hayley Chisholm, wherever you are, legend. She connected me to lots of different poets. And I started to see that the poets that we were exposed to in the curriculum, they didn't really have my narrative. And I wanted to read more widely, particularly Black poets, people of colour, really fascinated by their stories. And being a page poet rather than a performance poet has prompted me to go and read a lot more widely too. And I'm really excited to be published with my poetry collection this year with Mangabala, because some of my most beloved poets are published by them, and I feel really honoured to have my book sit by theirs on their little shelf. So I guess that was my journey into poetry. And from then, working at Red Room has really helped me to read more widely, to see a lot more poetry in all of its forms, you know, and it's exciting to see visual poems and digital poems and coded poems and poetry moving away from what we thought of it originally as being page things or spoken things.
And I said, it's not cool, it's not rock and roll. But then I realized it absolutely is, because it's music. That's all really poetry, largely.
Yeah.
What a perfect place to finish our conversation today. Look forward to hearing more from you at the NT Writers Festival in Alice Springs, beginning on Thursday this week. Fiona, Future and Curly, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
ABC Radio, Darwin.
Don't forget that.